I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world on Easter weekend. On the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., we broadcast around the world from a UAE now in its fifth week of being the most targeted country by Iranian missiles and drones because of the Trump-Netanyahu war. The war has killed, wounded, or displaced more than a million, and billions have been impoverished by ensuing price inflation. And it's a war many refer to as Epstein fury, Trump's distraction to bury reputational damage from the Epstein Files Transparency Act. The Epstein class is no longer a headline in so-called mainstream media. Martin Luther King Jr., for his part, killed 58 years ago, would have surely opposed the war in Iran, like he passionately opposed the Vietnam War, in which the USA was defeated after millions were killed. This Iran war is, according to polls, even more unpopular than 1970s U.S. wars on Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Donald Trump's former White House communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, is the author of bestseller From Wall Street to the White House and Back, The Scaramucci Guide to Unbreakable Resilience. The founder of global investment firm Skybridge Capital joins me now from New York. Thank you so much, Tony, for coming back on Going Underground. Obviously, time is against us in one way. We don't know by the time this is broadcast whether the ground troops are there already, whether the USA has left NATO. I mean, perhaps more generally, can I ask, you knowing Donald Trump in the Oval Office, as it were, what does he look like? How does he feel when he is defeated or facing defeat?
I'm not sure if he's defeated or not. I mean, we are, first of all, happy Easter to you and your viewers. I would just say to you that I wasn't a supporter of this. If somebody asked me about it before it started, I would have not started the war. I think probably lots of our Gulf allies would have probably agreed with that. And now you have the doctrine of all these unintended consequences. So we're sitting here and we could end up having troops there or not having troops there. But to me, I would like to see a de-escalation and a diplomatic solution. But the question right now is, I don't necessarily see how you get there from where we are right now. I guess one of the big issues will be if the United States pursues a more aggressive strategy than it's currently pursuing, then my guess is they're going to go to shut down the oil. And that would mean all the oil trafficking through the strait, to see if they could force a negotiation and perhaps get the Chinese to the table to force a negotiation to create some type of regime change in Iran. That's what I think is the most likely outcome.
I mean, I know you've been in touch with some staffers, perhaps in the administration. It's very opaque. We don't really know whether Colonel Tulsi Gabbard, the National Security Director of National Intelligence, is against or for this. We don't know about J.D. Vance.
I think it's pretty obvious that she was against it. I think J.D. Vance was against it. I think that stuff's well-documented and well-reported. I think remember, the one thing that's going on that somebody like me wouldn't like is that the decision-making is being made by a council of one. And I think that is quintessentially not American. Americans dating back to George Washington always operated more with a consensus and with a team. I just think you mentioned Martin Luther King Jr., so let's go to John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, he made the decisions, but it was after asking the right questions. I think so one of the problems happening here, good presidents may not know the right answer, but what good presidents are really good at are asking the right questions.
But is he in a position to ask questions? I mean, we know that, whilst Trump is asking Congress for $200 billion, this was in, after 2 weeks or 3 weeks of the war, Miriam Adelson gave him $250 million. We know that Netanyahu is with him, and, you know, there's lots of speculation on what Netanyahu has on Donald Trump. Is he really a hostage, Donald Trump?
So, you know, I don't know, so I don't want to speculate about that stuff. You mentioned the Epstein stuff earlier on. I do think that that is a problem for him, and I think that the war has put that on the back burner, but I don't think that that's going away because he's had members of his own party break from him on that topic, right? Thomas Massie has teamed up with Ro Khanna on that topic, so it's not clear to me that whatever is in there that could be potentially damaging to him won't get exposed. It feels, still feels like that is a big risk to him. But, you know, again,
I mean, that's exposed in the files. That's exposed in the files that have been given. Netanyahu supposedly having more than is in the actual files that.
But you and I both know that there's 3 million files that they haven't exposed. And 2 days after the war, they took his files that had his name in it. 48,700 of them they removed 2 days after the war happened. So there's circumstantial evidence that would suggest that some of this is related to that. You know, look, I'm an American, so and I have traveled with Americans to Iraq and Afghanistan as a civilian on troop support missions. I have traveled into military hospitals and visited veterans that have been wounded in war. I am not for the war. I would just tell that to anybody. There's always a doctrine of unintended consequences. I'm talking about American casualties, but there are also civilian and innocent casualties. So for me, I'm not for the war.
Sorry to interrupt there, Tony, but are they unintended or are they actually intended consequences? Trump must know that there will be mass killing of American servicemen and women.
Well, again, I'm talking about the unintended consequences of civilians. I don't think they wanted to drop a bomb on a school. I mean, I would like to still believe that actually. So I'll maintain that belief. But I think obviously if you're putting ground troops in place, you're going to have casualties. You know, Trump was pretty callous about that in one of his remarks to the press where he said, well, you know, deaths are going to happen. I thought it was pretty callous. I don't remember Dwight Eisenhower or other American leaders talking about it in that way. So, or Pete Hegseth for that matter. So for me, I want the outcome to be beneficial in the following respect. I would like the de-escalation of combat to happen. I would like there to be some secularization of Iran, because you know this, you live in the region. If you look at their constitution, they continually talk about exporting the radical nature of their fundamentalism. It's literally the first or second line in their constitution. We know that they have militia proxies all over the region.
That's been revised a huge number of times, that constitution.
Listen, we can debate whether or not.
No, but since you raised that, Iran was an ally of the United States under the Reagan administration. So Iran has long collaborated with Israel and the United States, infamously, under Reagan. So there's no. Okay, and so, I've lived in Iran, and there's a lot of love for the United States in Iran.
Okay, so listen to me. I have a lot of respect for the history and the culture of Iran. And Scott Anderson wrote a great book called The King of Kings last fall, which I'd recommend to everybody to read. The Americans do not do well with regime change. If you go from Mossadegh to the Shah and then out to Khomeini, okay, that's not a great track record for the Americans who are trying to influence regime change in Iran. So, you know, it's a very complex situation. I'm not trying to simplify it. A lot of people will come onto your show and be jingoistic and try to simplify it. I'm not trying to simplify it. I'm just telling you that I'm reasonably close to more than one Gulf leader. I've had more than one interpersonal conversation with more than one Gulf leader that does not like the paramilitary proxies, does not like the state-sponsored support of terrorism, and does not like the undue influence that they're trying to perpetrate in their countries. And I think that that's a fact. And so you could disagree with me on that. That's fine. I don't think that was enough to go to war, by the way. Okay, so I was not in agreement with the war, but we're in it now. So here are the goals that I would like to see happen. One, I would like to see a de-escalation. Number two, I would like to see a defanging of that notion. I think these paramilitary groups are just not helpful to the region if you want peace and prosperity. You know, you live in a country and you live in a city, to me, that is like an oasis. It to me is a representation of what human beings can do if they think forward and positively about economic innovation, economic growth, and peace and prosperity. So the city you're living in, to me, is a model for many, many cities, frankly, including cities here in the United States. So I would like to return to something like that, as opposed to having missiles being fired at each other. So that's me, okay? And I'm also old enough now, and I've experienced the horror of war. Two of my family members were wounded in World War II. They both survived, but they were severely wounded, one at the Battle of the Bulge and one on Normandy Beach, okay? And these are my uncles. So to me, I'm not a fan of it, but we're here now. I would ask people to think about three things: a de-escalation, a defanging of state-sponsored terrorism, and then a restatement of what I see is the future of the Middle East, which is growth and prosperity, and you know, less dependence on oil, frankly, and more dependence on some of the softer things that are going on in that beautiful city that you live in.
Well, I mean, what you call the state-sponsored support of terrorism, of course, is what Iran calls the support of liberation movements in the face of Israeli aggression, Israel being a proxy of the United States, as seen from that perspective, and as seen from the perspective of a lot of the Arab world. You don't think,
I'm willing to denounce, because you and I have had this conversation before, I'm willing to denounce certain Israeli actions in Gaza. But I would also expect you to also denounce what happened on October 7th, because I've seen the films. I've seen the IDF films.
Yeah.
So,
my job is just to be impartial. I can't denounce anything here. But the point is, Joe Kent, of course, you don't look that impartial, my brother.
You don't look that impartial to somebody like me. My point is the violence on both sides is reprehensible, and we got to get to a transformative leadership moment where we help these people as opposed to killing innocent people. That's all.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that sidesism, of course, is something that Martin Luther King Jr. referred to in his infamous Vietnam speech, saying that that can actually see you to committing war crimes. Joe Kent, the head of counterterror for Trump, chosen by Trump, said the war is for Israel. You didn't believe his resignation letter?
I know Trump pretty well, okay? I'm not saying that Netanyahu didn't influence him, because obviously J.D. Vance, it was reported, he had a rebuking phone call with Netanyahu about the overselling of a simplistic outcome for the war. So I'm not saying that Joe Kent isn't partially true, but I know Trump pretty well. I don't think that he makes a decision for anybody, okay? And there's actually danger in what I'm saying, okay? The decisions are made in the United States right now by a committee of one. Abraham Lincoln, there was a great book written about him 20 years ago called A Team of Rivals, where he put a team of rivals in place to help him make decisions. Trump has a team of mirrors. They're all trying to reflect back to him what they think he wants, and they're frankly just a team of obsequious yes men. So, but to me, I think Trump made that decision. If you want to tell me that, you know, Netanyahu's pulling him around by the nose, I don't buy that, actually, because I've known Trump for over 20 years. And in fact, if anybody even suggested that, he would reflexively do the opposite of that. So I don't buy that he can't be both things. He can't be both things. He can't be easily influenced and then the unicorn that he represents on the world stage in terms of the arbitrary, capricious nature of his decision-making.
Anthony Scaramucci, I'll stop you there. More from Donald Trump's former White House communications director and the host of the Open Book podcast after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Donald Trump's former White House communications director, Anthony Scaramucci. Tony, we were talking about the geopolitics, as it were. You are, of course, the founder of Skybridge Capital. I'm sure it's been quite a time as regards investments. Of course, thousands have been killed in Iran, a million displaced in Lebanon. The Financial Times had a headline here: foreign central banks sell U.S. treasuries amid war in Iran. Something that, you know, over the BRICS multipolarity headlines that we've seen in recent years since the Ukraine war started, we're kind of getting used to. But now people talking about the petrodollar, regardless of what happens, as regards a ground invasion, the mass casualties, whatever happens, what impact do you think it has on, I mean, the USA is more than the petrodollar. But explain that to our audience of how that works and the money is recycled from oil sales into securities and treasuries.
Well, I think the first thing we would have to do is just take a step back and explain what the ideas were, you know, 1974, Kissinger, et cetera. The ideas where we would have hard and soft power, but generally guided towards helping peace and prosperity in the Middle East, and which is why we're able to build so many successful allied relationships on the Arabian Peninsula. And so what's happened now is Trump pulls USAID. He gets bellicose with his rhetoric against our allies. I think the stuff that he said about the crown prince, frankly, in Saudi Arabia, I wish he didn't say. I think it was inappropriate, frankly, and not necessary. And so now what you're doing is you're creating a setup of some tension where people are going to want to devolve themselves from the United States. And I want to give you this historical point because I think it's very, very important. It's a very unique country in terms of its political power and the size of its GDP and its military to have generally good alliances around the world. That was fairly a unique proposition if you really think of 5,000 years of global recorded history. And so Trump is sort of going against
I was born in Britain, of course. So the United States took it from the British Empire, of course.
Yeah, but you know, the United States, we've had some pockets of colonialism, sir, but we have not had the, you know, and Roosevelt hated the colonialism, you know, and so we didn't have the presence and the colonialism and the mercantilist economy.
Well, some would say that was USAID. That was USAID that you're criticizing Trump for destroying.
Okay. All right. You can say that if you can, but I, you know, I worked on those projects. Remember, I was at the XM Bank I was chief strategy officer there at the XM Bank. And I can tell you that the people that I worked with didn't look at it that way. They looked at it like this was a way to help people. And by the way, you know, the Chinese, for that matter, I think have been very successful with their Belt and Road Initiative and some of the things that they've done in Africa and some of the things they've done throughout the Middle East and even in Latin America. So again, if you're a superpower in the world, how are you going to handle yourself? With benevolence or with malevolence? You got to make that decision. And I would just say that we've made a mistake by withdrawing that stuff, me personally. And so when you do that, then you create unnatural alliances or you get your allies to turn against you. But here's the thing, and here's the opportunity, frankly. If there is a path towards secularization in Iran, there's a path where we could, frankly, the U.S. could team up with the Chinese and come up with a structure that everybody in the Gulf could live with, that could help repair Iran and bring Iran back into the family of nations where the sanctions are reduced, their infrastructure is rebuilt, and you know the oil, 80% of which is going to China, ends up going to China, and maybe it goes to China at more market-based prices as opposed to these discounts as a result of the sanctions. You know, you could set up America for another 30 years of dollar supremacy. It's possible. I'm not saying it's going to happen. And one of the things I know as an investor, I've been humbled by life. I've been humbled by markets. You know, I got fired by Trump after 11 days. So I've been humbled by my short stay in politics. So I say this to you very humbly. I'm not saying it with any grand vision, but I'm saying to you, there is an opportunity here where we could end up with a peaceful resolution and something that benefits the Iranians. Now, I can only go by American reports. You could tell me if this is wrong. But in America, it is reported that 85% of the people in Iran don't like the regime.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, I don't know if that's true.
I think that's the problem. And obviously, it comes from that propaganda.
Okay, so is that the wrong problem?
I mean, having lived there, there's no secularization that's on offer. So I'm not sure about that outcome.
Right,
but the fact is, it is being traded in yuan oil at the moment. And also, I suppose I want to get onto the point that far from a lot of critics of Trump talking about the invocation of the 25th Amendment. Is this actually a last gasp of U.S. hegemony? This is actually a brilliant idea to go to war with Iran, because the you mentioned the Belt and Road earlier. That integrates into the north-south transport corridor between India and Iran and into Russia. And is this actually all about trying to upend these huge strategic transport corridors that were being forged and were really the obvious pinpoints of light for multipolarity and BRICS?
It could be. I'm not going to make a case against that. I'm gonna say to you that there was a British scholar by the name of Mackinder, who basically said whoever controls the Eurasian continent will control the world. And if you look at U.S. foreign policy over the last 100 years, it's been Mackinder focused on making sure that that landmass that you're describing isn't necessarily controlled by one power. So it could be part of that. But again, listen, I'm a peace-loving person, okay? I want to make money and I want to take care of my family, as I would imagine many of the people that listen to your show. So for me, the best way to do that is to balance power in the world. And the best way to do that is to check each other at the door with our aggression. And so we've got to get to a point of de-escalation. And I'm going to make a prediction on your show. I predict that the Americans will find a way to team up with the Chinese to create some type of resolution in the Gulf. That's my prediction. I think one of the things that that President Trump did was he postponed his meeting with President Xi until that potential outcome could be clearer. And so that's what I'm hopeful for. And again, you know, I'm not one of these Americans that rails against the Chinese. You know, I understand that we can cohabitate, even though we have very different systems. But I am an American for people having the opportunity to live a successful and prosperous life like you guys have been able to do in Dubai. And I would like to see that happen. And so those are the things that I want to promote.
There is, of course, an alternate reality here, which is that the United States, as it normally does, has to retreat in defeat, in which case there are no U.S. bases here in the GCC.
Well, you said you were unbiased.
I'm just giving you the other. A moment ago, I gave you a pro-Trump. I gave you a pro-Trump, but now I'm giving you an against Trump.
I'm not pro-Trump. I think Trump is a nut.
You know,
I'm not pro-Trump.
Anything, clearly. You know,
okay, there was a little bit of derision, as they normally do. Okay, go ahead. But just got to hand check you on your own show.
That is true. Go ahead. From Vietnam onwards.
Go ahead.
But I mean, so could it actually be good for BRICS even without the unitary grand plan that you are hoping for, that is behind all these Trump decisions? That BRICS becomes stronger. The UAE, of course, with Iran, are the newest members of BRICS. Iran very keen on BRICS. No U.S. bases in the GCC countries. Saudi Arabia, of course, they did call out the genocide in Gaza. Perhaps going to be the newest next BRICS member. Can you see that future as well as the alternate outcome?
Listen, anything is possible. But remember, the reserve currency has usually fallen to the country that has the largest GDP and has the largest military, and also, the BRIC countries have certain things in common, but they have certain things where they diverge. The one thing about America, which people are fascinated by, it's a 50-state free trading bloc with a single currency and a uniform central bank. Now, Trump has challenged a lot of our norms, but that system over 250 years has been fairly decentralized, a result of which it hasn't been overly politicized. So Trump's putting pressure on it now. And so your points that you're making, I think everything that Trump is doing is helping the BRICS potentially come up with a substitute solution for the U.S. dollar, but they're up against a lot because they're up against that uniform free trading bloc that I just described, uniform central bank, and fairly decentralized rule of law system in America. And, you know, Trump's got 2.5-3 years to go. When he leaves, it's not clear to me we're going in a Trump MAGA-like direction after he leaves. I feel like this is a cult of personality, and we'll return to something that's a little bit more stable and a little bit more predictable. So I don't think it's going to be easy to dislodge the American dollar, at least over the next decade.
We won't know if it's too late by then. But of course, we're running out of time. I wanted to get onto whether he's leaving NATO, the war in Ukraine, of course, whether that is lost as regards.
Look, I mean, he's a lover of Vladimir Putin. He's like a knave of Vladimir Putin. So the real question is, I think Putin's got something on him. You think Netanyahu's got something on him. But I mean, the way he talks about Vladimir Putin, it just makes me laugh. I mean, it's obviously, you know, if the window's open and you hear clippity-clop outside, it's a horse, it's not a zebra. We shouldn't overthink it. I mean, he's obviously got something on him, the poor guy.
You don't see that as his understanding of mutually assured destruction and the fact that Russia has more nuclear weapons than any other country.
I don't see it as that at all. I think, listen, you know, he's not pulling out of NATO. I know we got to end the show, but he's not pulling out of NATO. His Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, actually got legislation passed to require 2/3 of a vote of the Senate to actually have a president unilateral declare. He could weaken NATO in his time in office, and he could say that he's soft pulling out of NATO as the commander in chief, but he's not going to pull out of NATO. We'll have NATO long after Trump is gone. But I think the real question is, what will happen in Ukraine? And my own feeling is the Ukrainians will have to outlast Trump before we get to a successful resolution of that war, because he's really done very little to help them. But this is another thing, the beauty of the American system. We're still providing support and signals intelligence, et cetera, because of the way our system works. A lot of things are happening in the country away from the president that are more consistent with our national security goals over multiple decades, as opposed to the capricious nature of one president.
And conversely, Russia has to win then before Trump leaves office. I did want to talk to you about crypto, of course, and why it's the arguably the most stable asset class during this war. But we need you for a whole program about that. Anthony Scaramucci, thank you.
It's great to be on with you. Happy Easter and happy Easter weekend.
Happy Easter. That's it for the show. Our thoughts are with all those affected by the Israeli-U.S. war here in West Asia. Our war coverage will continue on Monday with a U.S. veteran and Senate contender whose arm was broken in the U.S. Congress protesting Trump's war in Iran. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.